Welcome to Lindy Upgrade Studio. Our TOEFL reading podcast helps you build the background knowledge, academic vocabulary, and useful expressions behind real TOEFL reading passages. So whether you're out for a run, at the gym, on your commute, or doing chores around the house, pop in your earbuds and let English sink in naturally.
And today we are diving into a really wild time in history. I mean, imagine moving to a new city, chasing this promise of a better life, a steady wage. And well, you get there and you find out the water you're drinking is literally mixed with your neighbor's waste.
Mm. Oh, yeah, it is a horrific image.
Right. And imagine like breathing air so thick with coal dust, it just blocks out the sun in these neighborhoods where disease just sweeps through cramped, windowless rooms and it just quietly erases entire families.
It sounds like, you know, the plot of some dystopian horror movie.
Exactly. But that was just a typical Tuesday in a 19th century industrial city.
It really was. So today we are looking at a really fascinating TOEFL academic reading passage. It's titled Urbanization in the 19th Century.
And if you're studying for the TOEFL or, you know, just trying to elevate your academic English, texts like this can look well. They can be incredibly intimidating at first glance.
Oh, absolutely. They're dense. They are just packed with complex historical concepts and like really heavy C1 level vocabulary.
Yeah, but our mission in this deep dive is to basically tear that density apart.
Right. We are going to explore this massive historical shift from rural farms to city factories.
And the horrifying public health disasters that followed.
Yes, and the brilliant engineering that saved these cities. Plus, the brand new social class that emerged from all that smoke.
And we've designed this specific deep dive for those of you at a B1 to B2 level in English. So we're going to keep our language clear.
Definitely. We'll break down the toughest academic terms using their roots and collocations.
And most importantly, we're really going to focus on the why and the how. We aren't just going to list historical facts.
No, we're going to explain the underlying mechanisms of how the modern world was actually built. Because having that deep background knowledge, it's like having a skeleton key for the TOEFL reading section. So many passages draw from this exact era.
It's true. So the passage opens by painting a picture of a world in sudden, almost violent motion.
Right. It says, the 19th century witnessed a dramatic shift in population dynamics because of urbanization.
And to really grasp the weight of that opening sentence, we need to understand what life looked like right before this shift.
So if we were to rewind the clock to, let's say, the year 1750.
Okay, 1750.
The vast majority of human beings on Earth lived essentially the same way their ancestors had lived for centuries.
Right. They lived in agrarian societies.
Exactly.
And an agrarian society is, well, it's one completely centered around farming and agriculture. Your daily life was deeply tied to geography and the natural world.
So if you were a farmer in like 18th century Europe, the rhythm of your day was dictated entirely by the sun.
You woke up when the sun rose and you went to sleep shortly after it set because, you know, candles and oil were expensive.
Yeah. And the rhythm of your year was dictated by the seasons, planting in the spring, harvesting in the autumn.
And the things people used, their clothes, tools, furniture, mostly made by hand. Human muscle and animal muscle did the heavy lifting.
Maybe if you were lucky, you lived near a river and had a water wheel.
Oh, right. To help grind grain or power a small loom. But a water wheel has a massive limitation.
You have to build your workshop exactly where the river flows. You are literally anchored to the geography of the natural landscape.
Exactly. And that geographical anchor is exactly what breaks in the 19th century. Which brings us to the underlying catalyst for this entire passage.
Industrialization.
Right. Human beings figured out how to harness a completely new form of power. We started burning coal to heat water, creating steam.
And we used that really highly pressurized steam to push pistons and turn massive iron gears, basically the steam engine.
The steam engine. And the beauty of the steam engine is that, well, it doesn't care where a river is.
No, not at all.
You don't need a waterfall. You just need coal and water, meaning you can build a massive steam-powered factory absolutely anywhere you want.
And factory owners realized that, hey, if they didn't need to be on a river, they could build their factories right next to each other.
Right, in central locations to share shipping routes and coal supplies.
So this is the mechanical how behind the concept of urbanization. Let's look at that word closely, actually, because it is the title of our text.
Yeah, urbanization.
If we take it apart, the root is the Latin word urbs. Spelled U-R-B-S, which simply means city.
You see it in words like urban, suburb, suburban.
Exactly. And then there's that really powerful suffix at the end. Ebilization. I-Z-A-T-I-O-N.
Yeah, whenever you encounter that suffix in an academic text, it signaled a process, the process of becoming something.
So urbanization is literally the process of an area becoming a city, or, you know, the massive movement of people from the countryside into urban areas.
And the text notes that this caused a dramatic shift in population dynamics, which is a great phrase. In academic English, dynamics refers to the forces or properties that stimulate growth, development, or change within a system.
It implies that a situation is active and complex,
Right.
not static.
Yes, exactly. If you read about population dynamics, it means the size, location, or age of a population is shifting rapidly due to underlying forces.
You'll see this word in other contexts too, like family dynamics in sociology.
Right, which refers to how family members relate and react to one another. The dynamics of a system are the moving parts that cause change.
And the biggest dynamic force in the 19th century was this new steam-powered factory system.
The passage continues by stating, the proliferation of factories and the promise of higher wages attracted a diverse workforce, including women and children.
Okay, let's unpack this. The visual I always get here is of a giant electromagnet.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, you have this massive smoking factory acting as a magnet placed in the middle of a developing town, and it's just pulling people away from their rural farms for miles around.
The pull was undeniably strong, and the text uses a fantastic C1 level word to describe the sheer volume of these new magnets.
Proliferation.
Right. And to understand proliferation, we can look at its Latin roots. Proles means offspring or children, and fere means to bear or to carry.
So the historical literal translation would be to bear offspring, to reproduce.
Exactly. But in modern academic English, the proliferation of something means a rapid, almost uncontrollable increase in numbers.
It's the idea of something multiplying quickly. The text says the proliferation of factories, meaning, well, there wasn't just one factory built.
Right. One factory proved profitable, so 10 more were built the next year, and 50 the year after that. They were just multiplying rapidly across the landscape.
You might see collocations on the TOEFL, like the proliferation of nuclear weapons in a political science text, or the proliferation of smartphones in a sociology passage.
Yeah, it always denotes a rapid, massive spread. And as these factories proliferated, they needed bodies to run the machines.
But here's where those family dynamics we mentioned earlier completely shattered. The text mentions a diverse workforce, including women and children.
Yeah.
How did the promise of higher wages completely change the family structure compared to, like, rural farm life?
Well, it fundamentally altered the concept of a family. On that 18th century farm, the family was a single economic unit working for direct survival, growing the wheat they were actually going to eat.
Right, but in the city, that survival mechanism just vanishes.
Exactly, because you can't eat coal or cotton. You are working purely for a wage, a piece of currency that you then exchange for food. Time itself became commodified.
You were no longer working until the harvest was done. You were clocking in and clocking out based on the factory whistle. Time literally became money.
And because these massive steam-powered machines were doing the actual heavy physical lifting, factory owners didn't necessarily need the brute physical strength of an adult male farmer to operate them.
Right, a machine just needed someone to pull a lever, tie a broken thread, or, God forbid, crawl under a loom to clear out dust.
Which is incredibly dangerous work. But factory owners quickly realized they could hire women and even children as young as 6 or 7 to do these tasks.
And crucially, they could pay women and children a fraction of what they paid adult men.
So suddenly, an 8-year-old child isn't just helping their parents weed the garden. That child is an individual wage earner.
Working 14 hours a day in a textile mill, bringing home money that the family absolutely desperately needs to survive in the city.
The entire psychological and social structure of the family was just turned inside out.
So while the promise was a better life and better living conditions,
The wage was supposed to mean freedom from the unpredictable nature of farming, where a bad drought could mean starvation.
yeah, but families taking those wages home from the factory floor quickly discovered that the utopian promise of industrialization had a deeply horrific reality.
Because they had to live somewhere. And that brings us to the dark side of this rapid growth.
The passage takes a really stark turn here. It reads, "Cities expanded rapidly, leading to overcrowded living conditions and inadequate infrastructure."
Let's look closely at how the text describes the skeleton of the city. They were dealing with entirely inadequate infrastructure.
And whenever you see that "in" prefix, just think not. The city literally did not have an adequate or sufficient foundation to support this many people.
And the word infrastructure itself is critical for any academic discussion of cities or nations. The prefix infra means below or underneath.
Okay.
And the structure, of course, is what is built. So the infrastructure is the understructure. It is the hidden physical skeleton that a society requires to function safely.
We are talking about the systems buried under the ground and hidden in the walls, right?
Exactly. The sewer pipes, the fresh water delivery systems, the paved roads, the bridges.
If a city is a living body, the infrastructure is the circulatory system.
I love that analogy. And in these early 19th century cities, that circulatory system was completely overwhelmed.
I mean, imagine a small town designed for 10,000 people. Suddenly, within a single decade, 200,000 people arrive to work in the proliferating factories.
The existing wells for drinking water can't handle the demand. There are no underground sewer pipes to carry away the waste of 200,000 people.
The text follows this up by stating, housing was often substandard and sanitation issues were prevalent.
That word, substandard, paints a grim picture. Sub meaning below. The housing was far below any acceptable standard of living.
It wasn't just a little cramped, right? It was a physical nightmare.
To give you a sensory idea of what substandard housing meant in places like 19th century London or New York, we really have to look at the tenement building.
Because the workers had to walk to the factories. There were no buses or trains yet. Everyone had to live as close to the factories as physically possible.
Right, and landlords realized they could make an absolute fortune by subdividing existing buildings into smaller and smaller rooms.
You'd have entire families of 6 or 7 people living in a single unventilated room.
No windows, no natural light, and absolutely no indoor plumbing.
A single outhouse in a muddy back alley might be shared by, like, 50 or 100 people.
And this leads directly to the next phrase. Sanitation issues were prevalent.
Prevalent is an adjective meaning widespread, common, or happening everywhere at a particular time.
Poor sanitation wasn't just happening in one bad neighborhood. It was prevalent across the entire working class section of the city.
The horrific result of all these factors colliding is laid out in the next sentence. As a result, urban areas became hotspots for diseases such as cholera and tuberculosis.
A hotspot is a place of intense, dangerous activity. And to really understand why the author highlights these two specific diseases, we need to dive into the mechanics of how they actually operated in these substandard conditions.
Yes. The mechanism of transmission is what made these cities so deadly. Let's look at cholera first.
Cholera is a severe bacterial infection of the intestines that causes rapid, extreme dehydration. And the terror of cholera is that it is waterborne.
Waterborne. It travels through contaminated drinking water.
Exactly, which means the inadequate infrastructure was literally weaponizing the water supply against the citizens.
Yeah. Without a proper understructure of sewer pipes, human waste from those overflowing alley outhouses simply seeped into the soil.
It seeped into the soil and drained directly into the shallow wells that the working class families were using for their daily drinking water. The system was inadvertently designed to poison the population.
That is just terrifying. And people didn't even know it was the water making them sick at first, did they?
No, they didn't. In 1854, during a massive cholera outbreak in London, most scientists still believed diseases were caused by miasma.
Miasma, meaning bad-smelling air.
Right. Oh. But a physician named Dr. John Snow began mapping the deaths in a specific neighborhood called Soho.
Oh, the famous John Snow map.
Yes. He realized that almost all the victims were pulling their drinking water from one specific pump on Broad Street. He mathematically proved the waterborne mechanism of the disease.
And he convinced the local authorities to remove the handle from the water pump.
And the outbreak in that area almost immediately starved. It was a monumental moment in public health, proving that the physical infrastructure of a city is directly tied to the biological survival of its people.
But water wasn't the only threat. The text also mentions tuberculosis, or TB.
And the mechanism for TB is entirely different. It doesn't need contaminated water.
Mm.
Tuberculosis is an airborne bacterial infection that primarily attacks the lungs.
It spreads when an infected person coughs, sneezes, or even just speaks, releasing microscopic droplets into the air.
Which is why the substandard, windowless tenement housing was the perfect incubator for the disease.
Because if you have 8 people sleeping in a tiny, damp, unventilated room, and one person develops tuberculosis?
The airborne bacteria cannot escape the room. It just circulates in the stagnant air. The disease thrived on the overcrowding. The closer humanity packed itself together, the more efficiently the bacteria could hunt.
Okay, when you look at the sensory reality of this, the contaminated water, the suffocating infected air, the grueling 14-hour workdays, it really begs a logical question. Well, if these cities were basically disease hotspots with terrible housing, why didn't people just pack up and go back to the countryside? Wasn't the farm safer?
That is the tragedy here. The bridge back to their old life had already been burned.
Really? How so?
Well, we talked about the pull of the city factories, but we also have to understand the push from the rural areas. The countryside was actively rejecting them.
Oh, because the steam-powered factories were producing goods at such a massive scale and at such a cheap price that the traditional economy of the countryside was destroyed.
Exactly. The small, hand-powered cottage industries couldn't compete. If you were a hand weaver in a village, it might take you a week to weave what a steam-powered loom could weave in an hour. Your skills were completely devalued by the machine.
And furthermore, agricultural practices were undergoing their own revolution.
Right? Yes. Wealthy landowners were aggressively buying up small, shared community farms and consolidating them into massive private estates. It was a process known as the enclosure movement.
And they started using new farming equipment that required far fewer human laborers.
Right. So there was no land left for the poor to farm and no jobs left in the villages. They were trapped.
They couldn't survive in the countryside and they were dying in the city. The entire industrial experiment was on the verge of collapsing under its own biological weight.
The system was broken and it forced humanity to figure out a solution almost out of sheer desperation.
So you can't just have millions of people living in sickness forever. Someone had to step in and fix the infrastructure.
Right, and that desperate need for a solution is what transitions our text into the era of the urban planners.
The passage reads, "Despite the challenges faced by urban planners and legislators, urbanization brought significant advancements in public transportation, communication, and commerce."
Let's focus on the word legislators for a moment, because you will see this word in almost any TOEFL passage dealing with government or social history.
The root here is the Latin lex, or legis, which means law. Think of words like legal, legitimate, or legislation.
And the suffix curator indicates a person who performs an action, similar to a creator or an operator.
So a legislator is a person who creates laws.
Exactly. These were the government officials, the politicians, and the municipal leaders who finally realized that if they didn't step in to regulate the chaos, these booming economic centers would simply die off.
The text says these planners and legislators brought about significant advancements, meaning profound progress or improvements.
But to really appreciate what an advancement a citywide sewer system is, we have to look at the sheer logistical impossibility of what they were trying to do. It was an engineering nightmare.
I always picture it, imagine trying to completely rebuild an airplane while you are already flying at 30,000 feet.
That is the perfect analogy.
You can't land the plane. You can't just ask 2 million people to evacuate London or New York for a year while you dig up the streets, lay down fresh water pipes, and build a massive underground sewer network.
Right. The cities were already overcrowded. Mm-hmm. The planners had to build the infrastructure, the hidden skeleton, directly underneath the feet of millions of people who were actively going to work every day.
Like the London sewer system, right?
Yeah.
Engineered by Joseph Bazalgette in the mid-19th century.
Yes. Following an event called the Great Stink of 1858.
The Great Stink? What a name.
Oh, it earned it. The smell of untreated human waste in the River Thames became so overpowering that the government could barely function in Parliament. So Bazalgette was tasked with building a solution.
And he didn't just build a few pipes.
No, he designed a sprawling, incredibly complex network of intercepting sewers, over 1,000 miles of street sewers and 82 miles of massive main underground brick sewers.
That is insane.
Yeah.
He had to dig up heavily trafficked streets, tunnel under buildings, and build massive pumping stations to lift the waste and move it away from the city's water supply.
It was an advancement of staggering proportions built right through the heart of the flying airplane.
And it wasn't just plumbing that was advancing. The passage specifically calls out public transportation.
We need to connect the dots here. How does a train or a streetcar solve the problem of substandard, overcrowded housing and tuberculosis?
Well, it changes the physical geography of human life, right?
Yes, exactly. Before public transportation, the golden rule of the city was that you had to live within walking distance of the factory.
If a factory employs 5,000 people, those 5,000 people and their families must be crammed into a 1 mile radius around that factory.
Which is the fundamental cause of the overcrowding. But the invention of the horse-drawn omnibus and later the electric streetcar and the early underground railways severed that requirement.
Because if a worker can hop on a cheap train, they can suddenly live 4, 5, or 6 miles away from the smoke and noise of the factory.
Public transportation acted as a release valve for the pressure of the city center. It allowed the city to physically expand outward, creating the very first suburbs.
Workers could commute. They could live in an area with cleaner air and a little more space, separating the industrial zones from the residential zones.
The passage also mentions advancements in communication and commerce.
If we think about the word commerce, which you can easily link to the B1 word commercial, like a TV ad trying to sell you something, commerce is the large-scale buying and selling of goods.
The factories were producing goods at a scale the world had never seen. But to manage that massive level of global commerce, you need instantaneous communication.
You can't wait 3 weeks for a letter to arrive by ship to know if a buyer in another country wants your textiles.
No, the crisis of speed forced the widespread adoption of the telegraph. Wires were strung up alongside the new railway lines, allowing information to travel at the speed of electricity.
The sheer scale of what was happening is mind-bending. They were laying thousands of miles of underground pipes, stringing telegraph wires across continents, and building railways to move millions of people.
It's unbelievable.
But, you know, here's where it gets really interesting. All this new commerce and infrastructure didn't just build roads. It built a brand new type of person.
Yes, the social engineering, the creation of a new mindset.
Exactly. The economy completely rewired society, which brings us to the fourth major movement in our passage.
The text states, the influx of people into cities also led to major cultural shifts and the rise of new social classes.
Let's look at the mechanics of the word influx first.
Influx is a powerfully descriptive noun. The prefix in simply means into. The root is the Latin fluxus, which literally means to flow.
Okay.
So when we talk about an influx, we aren't just talking about a few people wandering into town. We are talking about a continuous heavy arrival.
Like water flowing into a pool or a river breaking its banks and flooding a valley.
Yes. It implies a wave that changes the landscape it flows into. On the TOEFL, you'll frequently see collocations like a massive influx of immigrants or an influx of refugees.
Or in an economics passage, an influx of capital, meaning a massive amount of investment money flowing into a market.
This specific influx of rural workers completely overwhelmed the old social order.
The text zeroes in on the result of this cultural shift. It says, a burgeoning middle class emerged, distinguished by its economic power and influence.
Now, if you are taking notes, underline, highlight, and circle the word burgeoning. It is a classic, highly tested C1 vocabulary word, B-U-R-G-U-N-I-N-G.
So to burgeon means to begin to grow or increase rapidly. Mm-hmm. It implies something that is flourishing, developing, and coming into its power.
Right.
Now, wait. We covered the word proliferation earlier, which also means growing rapidly. How should a learner distinguish between proliferation and burgeoning?
That's a great question. It comes down to nuance and collocations. Proliferation usually focuses heavily on the sheer number or quantity of something multiplying, like the proliferation of factories or weeds or weapons.
It can almost have a negative or overwhelming connotation.
Exactly. Burgeoning, on the other hand, is often used to describe something developing, blossoming, or coming into its own strength.
Ah, so you might read about a burgeoning talent in a young musician, a burgeoning romance, or, as we see here, a burgeoning middle class.
Yes, it implies a vibrant, energetic growth.
And the text says this burgeoning middle class was distinguished by its economic power. To be distinguished means to be set apart or to be made different because of a specific defining quality.
And to truly grasp why a middle class was such a massive cultural earthquake, we need to take a quick look at the background of social hierarchies before the 19th century.
Right, because for centuries, European society was essentially a dynary system. It was divided into two extreme ends of the spectrum.
At the very top, you had the aristocracy, the royalty, the dukes, the earls. Their wealth was generational. It was tied to the fact that they owned the land, and they inherited their power simply by being born into the right family.
And at the absolute bottom, you had the peasantry. The farmers, the manual laborers, the servants.
They owned no land, they had zero political power, and there was virtually no way to change your status. If you were born a peasant, you died a peasant.
There was a massive empty chasm between the mud hut and the castle.
But the steam-powered factory system required an entirely new type of worker to function.
Yeah, if you are a wealthy factory owner, you cannot personally oversee 3,000 workers on the factory floor every single day.
You need to hire managers. You need accountants to keep track of the massive influx of commerce.
You need lawyers to draft the contracts for shipping your goods on the new railways. Mm-hmm. You need engineers to design and fix the machines.
You need clerks to send the telegraphs.
And you have to pay those professionals a good salary. They aren't doing manual labor, but they also aren't royalty. They sit right in the middle.
Hence, the middle class. They were the administrative and professional layer that made industrial commerce possible. They had steady, reliable incomes.
And this brings us to a crucial concept, disposable income. For the first time in history, a large segment of society had money left over after buying the basic necessities of survival.
They didn't just buy bread, they bought books. They bought tickets to the theater, they bought nicer clothes, they bought newspapers.
And that disposable income translated directly into what the text calls economic power and influence. But so what does this all mean? Does having economic power automatically give a new class influence?
Not automatically, no, but it makes the demand for political influence inevitable. The psychology of this new middle class is fascinating.
Because they looked at the aristocratic lords who were running the government lords, who often knew nothing about industry or commerce, and they realized a stark truth.
The middle class was the engine of the country. They were the ones managing the factories, tracking the finances, and generating the wealth of the nation.
So they naturally started asking, if we are generating all this wealth, and we have the education and the money, why don't we have a voice in how the laws are made?
Why should an aristocratic landowner make the rules for our industrial cities?
They realized that their economic power meant nothing if they couldn't influence the legislation that governed their lives.
They weren't born into royalty, so they decided to use their money and their collective voice to demand a seat at the table. They demanded the right to vote. They demanded representation in government.
Which leads us perfectly to the final, incredibly impactful segment of our passage. The text explains how this new class actually used their newfound power to fix the problems we discussed in segment two.
It says, this class played a pivotal role in advocating for social reforms, including improved working conditions and public health measures.
Let's pull out that word pivotal.
Pivotal is an excellent adjective that you can use in almost any academic essay. The root is the noun pivot.
Think about a physical pivot, like the central pin, point, or shaft on which a mechanism turns. In basketball, a player keeps one foot on the ground as a pivot foot while turning their body. Everything rotates around that central point.
Exactly. So if a group plays a pivotal role in history, it means their involvement was of crucial central importance. The outcome literally turned on their actions.
Without them, the mechanism of change wouldn't have worked.
And the action they were taking was advocating. Let's break this word down. The prefix ad means to or toward.
And the root is the Latin volk, which means voice or to call. You'll recognize this root in words like vocal, vocabulary, or vocalize.
So to advocate means, quite literally, to add your voice toward something.
In modern English, to advocate means to publicly support, recommend, or argue for a particular cause or reform. To add your voice to a cause.
The burgeoning middle class was adding their powerful, educated voice toward the cause of social reform.
Now, a critical thinker reading this passage might pause here and ask a challenging question. Why did the middle class advocate for these reforms?
Right.
Why not just the factory workers who were actually suffering in the substandard housing?
Yeah.
Why weren't they the ones leading the political charge for change?
It's a tragic reality of the era, and we can infer this from synthesizing the different parts of the text. The factory workers were trapped in a brutal cycle of physical exhaustion and poverty.
When you were working 80 hours a week, just to earn enough to buy a loaf of bread, and your family is constantly threatened by disease, you simply do not have the time, the physical energy, or the financial resources to organize a massive political lobbying campaign.
You are operating purely in survival mode. You can't advocate for legislation if you don't even have the time to read the newspaper, or in many cases, the ability to read at all.
They lack the economic power and influence that the middle class possessed.
And on the other end of the spectrum, the traditional aristocracy largely ignored the problem. They lived on massive country estates, far away from the smog, the cholera, and the overcrowded tenements.
The suffering of the urban poor didn't touch their daily lives.
But the middle class was trapped right in the middle of the mess. The middle class lived in the cities. They walked the same streets.
And if they were highly educated, they read the newspapers detailing the cholera outbreaks.
But their advocacy wasn't just driven by pure moral charity. It was largely driven by what we might call enlightened self-interest.
Enlightened self-interest. The idea that doing good for others is ultimately good for yourself.
Exactly. The middle-class managers and accountants realized that a sick, dying workforce is terrible for commerce. You cannot run a profitable factory if half of your workers are incapacitated by tuberculosis.
Furthermore, the biology of the city didn't respect social boundaries. If the inadequate infrastructure allows cholera to seep into the groundwater, the bacteria doesn't care if you're a poor laborer or a middle-class lawyer. If you drink the water, you die.
So, to protect themselves and their own economic interests, the middle class had to clean up the city. They used their political influence to lobby the legislators.
They advocated for the creation of public health boards. They advocated for labor laws like the Factory Acts in Britain, which finally put limits on child labor and mandated safer working conditions.
They were the engine that drove the societal cleanup. And that profound transformation brings us to the concluding thought of the passage. Ultimately, urbanization laid the groundwork for modern society.
That compound word, groundwork, is such a perfect metaphor to end on. The groundwork is the preliminary foundation.
It is the necessary, often messy digging and pouring of concrete that has to happen before you can build the beautiful house on top of it. You will see the collocation laid the groundwork everywhere in academic writing.
The author is making a sweeping, powerful argument here. The text isn't denying the horrors of the 19th century. It acknowledges the numerous terrifying obstacles, the diseases, the exploitation, the substandard housing.
But it argues that the sheer friction of millions of people colliding in these early cities forced humanity to adapt. The crisis forced the invention of modern infrastructure.
It forced the creation of public transportation. It birthed the middle class that demanded political rights and public health laws.
It is incredibly humbling to think about. Whenever I turn on the tap in my kitchen and clean, safe water flows out, or when I hop on the subway to get across town, or even when I enjoy the concept of a weekend off from work.
We are directly benefiting from the groundwork laid during this brutal, chaotic era. We are living our modern lives in the safe, regulated house that they built on top of that terrible, messy foundation.
It really changes how you look at the city around you. The infrastructure isn't just concrete and steel, it's the physical legacy of a massive social struggle for survival.
We have covered an immense amount of historical and linguistic territory in this deep dive. Let's pull it all together into a cohesive summary so you, our listener, can see how the narrative arc of this text functions as a whole.
Being able to mentally summarize a dense text is one of the most powerful skills you can bring to the TOEFL.
The historical narrative flows like a chain of cause and effect. It begins with the catalyst of industrialization, the steam engine, which acted as a massive magnet, pulling rural folks away from the agrarian countryside and into the new factories.
This massive migration was the process of urbanization.
But the physical cities weren't ready. That massive influx of people overwhelmed the inadequate infrastructure.
Because the understructure of the city failed, families were forced into substandard housing where diseases like cholera and tuberculosis became prevalent.
Yet that very crisis forced a reaction. Legislators and urban planners had to build the airplane while flying it. They engineered incredible advancements in public transport and commerce to save the cities from collapsing.
And out of that bustling, massive commercial system grew a burgeoning middle class. Because they possessed the economic power to survive and the education to understand the problems, they played a pivotal role in advocating for the health and labor reforms that ultimately laid the groundwork for the safe, modern society we live in today.
And right there, woven into that summary, is your essential C1 vocabulary for this topic.
Let's do a rapid-fire review. Say them with me or recall them mentally. Urbanization.
Proliferation, describing the rapid multiplication of factories.
Inadequate.
Infrastructure.
Burgeoning.
Advocating.
Advocating. If you can understand not just the definitions of these words, but how they connect the causes and effects of history together, you will be able to navigate any reading passage on this era with absolute confidence.
That is the real power of background knowledge. You aren't just memorizing definitions, you are understanding the human story behind the vocabulary. Before we wrap up today's deep dive, there's one final provocative thought I want to leave you with, a way to connect this 19th century history directly to your life right now.
The text clearly outlines how physical urbanization laid the groundwork for the modern physical world. The crowded, unregulated cities forced the invention of physical infrastructure. But consider the spaces we inhabit today.
Like the internet, social media, and digital spaces. Are we currently experiencing a massive digital urbanization?
Think about it. Over the last two decades, billions of humans have migrated from isolated analog lives into massive centralized online platforms.
We have had a massive influx of users into digital cities controlled by giant tech factories.
And just like the 19th century, the digital infrastructure is proving to be entirely inadequate for our mental and social well-being. We have a proliferation of misinformation, a loss of privacy, and algorithms designed to maximize our time on screen, much like the 14-hour factory shifts.
We are living in a digital environment with prevalent substandard sanitation when it comes to the truth. We have digital hotspots for emotional contagion and viral anger.
The parallels are striking. The early physical cities were toxic until a middle class demanded reform. So the question for our era is, who is going to advocate for digital public health?
Who are the modern legislators and planners who will step in, dig up the virtual streets, and build the digital infrastructure we need to survive this new kind of urbanization?
That is a profound question. History isn't just a list of dates in the past. The dynamics simply repeat themselves in new environments. I hope that gives you something deeply fascinating to think about on your run, or your commute, or wherever this audio finds you today.
This episode was created by Lindy Upgrade Studio. Until next time, keep upgrading your English.